This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As America continues its war against terrorism, Andrew Bacevich warns that there are limits to what military power can accomplish. In his new best-selling book, The Limits of Power, he writes that we are now engaged in a war with no exits and no deadlines, and that we are piling up debts that we are hard-pressed to meet. Bacevich is a retired Army colonel who fought in Vietnam. He's now a professor of history and international relations at Boston University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Last year, his 27-year-old son, First Lieutenant Andrew Bacevich, was killed in an IED explosion in Iraq. Michael Winship, a writer on Bill Moyer's Journal, wrote this about my guest. Bacevich speaks truth to power, no matter who's in power, which may be why those of both the left and right are eager to hear his views. Perhaps it's also because when he challenges American myths and illusions, he does so from a genuine patriotism forged in the fire of his own experiences. Andrew Bacevich, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe us as being in a war with no exits and no deadlines. Would you explain what you mean?
Well, I've described it as that because that's what the Bush administration has described it, or the way they've described it. I mean, shortly after 9/11, and announcements both from the Department of Defense and from the White House, the Bush administration went out of its way to indicate that this was really an open-ended war. The Pentagon of late has begun to use the term generational war. So the tendency of Americans to think of the war as Iraq, with perhaps Afghanistan hovering slightly in the background, really doesn't do justice to the ambitions of the Bush administration when it commenced the global war on terror.
And by that you mean?
I mean that it seems quite clear to me that at the outset, the strategy— And you almost need to put strategy in quotes because I believe it was so reckless and misguided. The strategy really was to prevent the recurrence of 9/11 or of something even worse than 9/11 by undertaking an effort to transform the greater Middle East. Douglas Feith, not too long ago, published a memoir in which he stated this quite specifically, quoting from documents that were written after 9/11. The Bush administration intended to drain the swamp of terrorists by bringing modernity or democracy or liberal values, whatever you want to call it, to the greater Middle East. And they believed that apart from the preliminary step of invading and transforming Afghanistan, the real main effort was to be Iraq. The expectation was that Iraq would be an easy case, easy both to win a military victory and easy to bring about significant political change, thereby establishing a precedent that in some way or another, not necessarily through direct military action, could be applied to other countries in the Arab and broader Islamic world.
You said that you think Americans overestimate what we can accomplish with military force. What do you think are some of the limits of military force that we're not quite getting?
Well, I think to understand the point, we have to reflect back, I think, to the end of the Cold War. You know, that period, 1989 to 1991, just a flurry of historical activity, beginning with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then in a sense culminating in Operation Desert Storm. It was at that moment, I think, that Americans generally, but our political elites particularly, came to believe that the United States, as the so-called sole superpower, possessed a military capacity unlike the world had ever seen, and that highly trained, professional, high-tech U.S. military forces now could allow the United States to use force to achieve political purposes in ways that no other nation in history had ever enjoyed. And it was that thinking, I believe, that informed that misguided strategy that the Bush administration conceived after 9/11. Now, what we've seen over the past 7 years, certainly in Afghanistan, but even more so in Iraq, is that our military power is actually far, far more limited than we imagined, especially given the fact that any adversary that we fight has some ability to make sure that the fighting happens as much on their terms as our own. And that's why we have become bogged down in these two really fairly small wars for such a long period of time.
Are you worried about the stresses that the war in Iraq and Afghanistan are putting on our military?
Well, it's not just that I'm worried about the stresses. I mean, I think there's been a drumbeat of concern on that point expressed not simply by people like myself who are opposed to administration policy, but expressed by the senior military leadership of the United States, by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who have repeatedly and publicly indicated that the stress on the force is not indefinitely sustainable. I mean, we all, as Americans, really should be in awe at the durability of our so-called all-volunteer force. The fact that we have young people going back for a third, fourth, fifth combat tour, the fact that measured by discipline and cohesion, the force has hung together so well. But this cannot continue indefinitely. And, the prospect of generational war is something that will inevitably at some point break the force.
You describe America's leaders as being unable or unwilling to address the disparity between what we want and what we can pay for.
Well, I think this is one what I hope readers will see as one of the major themes of my book, is that we have for several decades now been living beyond our means, and I try to provide a certain amount of empirical data to support that point. Whether it's dependence on foreign oil, or whether it's trade imbalance, federal deficit, increased borrowing. I mean, the national debt is now approaching $10 trillion on a $14 trillion economy. So we've got a fundamental imbalance between that which we have come to expect as intrinsic to the American way of life and that which we're willing to pay or able to pay. I also believe that in many respects, the ambitious and I think highly militarized U.S. foreign policy of the post-Cold War era really represents an effort to postpone a day of reckoning, to push back the day when we're going to have to recognize the imperative of living within our means.
You talk about what you describe as the rise of a new political elite whose members have a vested interest in perpetuating the crises that provide their source of power. What's this political elite that you're referring to?
Well, that's a pretty harsh charge, but it's one that I'm willing to stick with. I mean, here I think the historical horizon is one that has to be even deeper. We need to go back really to the end of World War II and the early days of the Cold War. And since that time, I think two things have happened that are very important for us to understand. The first is that the legislative branch of government has basically thrust power and authority towards the executive branch on almost anything that relates, however remotely, to national security. And the result is the imperial presidency, an imperial presidency that many of us bemoan, but that, frankly, both political parties wish to sustain. They simply want to own the imperial presidency. So that's the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened is that the ever-increasing emphasis on national security as the paramount priority has resulted in foreign policy becoming less and less democratic, or to put it another way, to foreign policy becoming the domain of a very small number of people, so-called wise men or wise women, who supposedly know more than the rest of us average citizens do, and who supposedly we can count on to make expeditious and wise decisions to keep us safe. My view is that this national security elite has failed us utterly.
You now think that Americans overestimate what we can accomplish with military force. When you were in the military, did you think that too?
No, I can't say that I did. I mean, although it's been a long time since I was in the military, and it was a different time. I mean, my military service corresponded for the most part with the latter half of the Cold War. I certainly believed that the Cold War was a worthy cause, that the policy of containment was a sound strategy and an essential strategy. But I also think I realized that the essence of that containment strategy was prudent. I mean, we didn't set out in 1975 to liberate Poland by invading Poland. Rather, we recognized that Soviet power had certain claims that needed to be respected, even if in a sense resisted, if we were going to maintain international stability and therefore secure our own well-being. It's really only in the aftermath of the Cold War that this militarized crusading instinct has manifested itself and I think has gotten us in a lot of trouble.
You say that when you were in the military during the Cold War, you were a cold warrior in uniform. You write, I was not oblivious to policy errors we had made and some of the sins we had committed, but as long as I was in uniform, I was willing to accept that these were peripheral to the larger narrative. How much did you think about the politics of the wars that you were, or the conflicts that you were involved with, starting with Vietnam when you were in the military?
I have to say I didn't think a lot about it. To use that old phrase, political consciousness, my political consciousness was not, frankly, raised until I took off my uniform and began to think about U.S. foreign policy in a more detached and critical way. I was commissioned in 1969 out of the military academy, which really means I was a cadet at West Point from 65 to 69. Really, the period from the time when the war was Americanized through the Tet Offensive and the beginning of the drawdown. So by the time I got to Vietnam in 1970, the war was already pretty much understood to be at least a mistake, if not simply a lost cause. I don't know how my classmates at the time or other officers of my generation approached their Vietnam service at the tail end of the war. But I know that I myself decided that at least the easiest approach, if not perhaps the wisest approach, was to sort of click my brain into neutral and try not to think too deeply about the politics of the Vietnam War at that point, but simply to, you know, do my best, to do my job, to perform my duties in a responsible way, and then to move on. It was really only after I got back from Vietnam that I began to think and read and study and certainly came to different conclusions about the war than I held in 1970 or so.
If you don't mind, I'd be interested in hearing what it was like for you in like 1970 when you were in the military and you were an officer in Vietnam and you knew that your country was just like totally torn in two over the war that you were fighting in. And yet you were able to remain detached from that fight and just do your job. You say you were pretty apolitical then. Was it easy or hard to be apolitical in such a politicized time, fighting in a war that was so politicized?
You know, I suspect if I had gotten my commission through ROTC, meaning if I'd spent the years 1965 to 1969, for example, here at Boston University where I teach, it probably would have been very difficult. But the military academy at that time, I don't know if you've ever visited West Point.
I haven't.
But it is really a physically isolated place along the Hudson River. And the program of socialization into the professional ethic that the military academy employed, at least in my day, was one that accentuated that isolation. Not simply physical, but I think intellectual and psychological. So in a very strange way, when the country came close to coming apart between 65 and 69, particularly in 1968, I think we at West Point viewed this as almost as detached spectators. You know, what does this have to do with us? That sounds very strange. But we were remarkably unaffected by all of the political turmoil related not simply to the Vietnam War, but to the social protest movements of the 1960s.
How did you go from being this detached, apolitical military officer to becoming what you are now, which is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University? You're immersed in international relations, in analysis of international relations, and strong opinions about foreign affairs.
Well, I mean, I think I've been on an intellectual journey, and I think that in the course of that journey, other aspects of my personal makeup or my personal history have probably come more to the fore, and my military background probably in some respects has receded in terms of shaping my thinking. I mean, I've been out of the Army now for 16 years. Basically, I got out of the Army at the time the Cold War ended. I have to say that in a loose, only partly formed way, I expected that the end of the Cold War would see the United States returning to becoming something akin to a normal nation. And I was taken aback when the end of the Cold War actually saw the United States becoming more ambitious, more assertive, more certain of the way the world was supposed to run.
You've been a pretty long-time opponent of the war in Iraq, but your son was a soldier who went to Iraq and died there in an IED explosion. What was it like for you to go watch him leave for a war that you didn't think should be fought?
Well, I really prefer not to talk about my son, and I prefer to keep that private. And I want to keep it private because I want to make sure that I never do anything that will seem to exploit his memory and his sacrifice. He is so dear to us that it's just better not to talk about him.
Let me ask you this, and this isn't directly about him, but I know a lot of people who have lost loved ones in the war feel that it's wrong during the war for other people to oppose it in a vocal way because it undermines morale. Or they feel that if there's strong opposition to the war, somehow it would mean that their loved one had died in vain.
Yeah, I will never try to instruct anybody who has lost somebody in this war. I will never try to instruct them about how they should deal with their grief, nor will I permit anybody to instruct me about how to deal with my grief and our grief. The position I take, and again, I'm not trying to say this is the position others should take, but the position I take is that my responsibility is to try to be a good citizen. People may differ over what that means, but I believe one thing it ought to mean, at least what it means to me, is that I should do my very best to speak the truth as I see the truth. I don't claim that what I see is somehow, that I've got all the answers, but it strikes me as irresponsible to remain silent in the face of policies. And I mean that in a very broad sense, not simply related to the Iraq War. I think it is irresponsible to remain silent in the face of policies that serve the nation so badly. And so I would just like in a very small way to try to contribute to a greater awareness of where we've gone wrong and in a very small way to try to suggest some alternative path.
As a foreign policy matter, you've said in your writing that you think what we need isn't a bigger military, it's a smaller foreign policy.
Absolutely. I mean, to go back to at least my understanding of the expectations that informed the global war on terror, that we're going to bring about this fundamental change in the Islamic world, that is so far beyond our ability to affect that it's almost laughable. The world is a difficult place. It's a complex place. There are people who hate us. There are national security threats. And therefore, we need an effective military. But quite frankly, we need to ratchet down our ambitions and expectations so that the tasks that we assign our military fall within the capabilities of our military to effect.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Bacevich, author of the best-selling book, The Limits of Power. It's about the limits of what military power can accomplish and about the implications of waging a global war on terror with no exits and no deadlines. Bacevich is a retired Army colonel who fought in Vietnam. His 27-year-old son, an Army lieutenant, was killed in Iraq by an IED explosion. Bacevich is now a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. What type of support would you like to see the American people show for the military? And I ask you, knowing this, that you don't even support the war, but you still have strong feelings about the troops who are there. And along with that, what sacrifices would you like to see the American people make as long as we are involved in war?
Well, I think as long as we are involved in an open-ended global war, that we ought to pay for the global war. I mean, Iraq itself has probably cost us somewhere to the tune of $800 billion. I know you're familiar with projections that it could cost us $2 to $3 trillion before it's over. And we're paying for that by borrowing, for the most part these days, borrowing from foreign countries. There's been no requirement for the American people to modify the way they live in order to underwrite the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, unless you call beefed up security at airports a sacrifice. So I think that if the war is important, then by golly, let's pay for it. But beyond that, I think that what I really would like, I think this is pie in the sky, but what I would really like to see in terms of what we owe soldiers is that to demand that a presidential election, which we're now facing, actually feature as a centerpiece a serious debate about U.S. foreign policy, serious questions to be raised about whether or not this so-called global war on terror really makes sense as a response to the threat posed by violent Islamic radicalism. Are there strategic alternatives? Or if we have no alternative but to continue this global war on terror for the next several decades, then what exactly is that going to cost and how is it going to be paid for? What are the additional resources that we're going to need to sustain a war for several decades? And where are they going to come from? It seems to me that the foreign policy debate that we actually get from both Senator McCain and Senator Obama tends to be exceedingly superficial and focus narrowly on the questions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And those are important questions. I mean, to a degree, they are important questions. But really, they beg the larger strategic question about the overall direction of U.S. foreign policy.
What are some of the questions you think they should be addressing?
Well, I think, I mean, to me, the core issue, is, will the global war on terror, which has landed us in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we remain many years later, will this ultimately achieve the objective that the Bush administration has laid out? Are we on a path that where we're going to see the Islamic world, you know, something like 1.4 billion people, are we on a path where we're going to pacify or liberate or dominate, depending on your point of view, this region of the world? And if the answer is no, and I believe the answer is no, then what are the alternatives? I mean, it seems to me that we have two experiments in invading and occupying countries with the expectation that that's going to produce some sort of useful political change, and both of those experiments would seem to me to be disappointments. So is there another way to deal with the threat posed by violent Islamic radicalism? I mean, there are specialists who say, yeah, there are other ways that we ought to be pursuing, for example, a strategy of containment in lieu of a strategy of liberation, as the Bush administration would style it. So that argument over strategic alternatives ought to be at stage center in the presidential campaign, and it's not.
Let's talk more about the alternatives that you see to waging war. You mentioned containment. What would that mean?
Well, containment here is not—it's not a synonym for isolation. Containment is not a synonym for detachment. I think it would mean at least some of the following things. Number one, we would greatly reduce our military footprint in the Islamic world, because our physical presence there, our military presence there, has the effect of exacerbating Islamic radicalism, not reducing it. I think that a strategy of containment would try to reduce the financial resources that are available to Islamists. And I don't mean simply by trying to cut off their access to bank accounts, but by having a genuine energy policy that would reduce the hundreds of billions of dollars that we're sending to Arab countries, some percentage of which inevitably gets siphoned off to support Islamist causes. I think containment would certainly continue to see intense intelligence collection as an effort to identify Al-Qaeda cells and similar organizations, and then an international police effort to reduce, destroy those cells. I think a strategy of containment should, at least on the margins, and we did this during the Cold War, during the strategy of containment, at least on the margins, should try to give indirect support or sustenance to liberal tendencies within the Islamic world, whether that's through public diplomacy, cultural exchanges, allowing students from the Islamic world to study in the West, a whole host of things. Now, a strategy of containment is not a strategy that's going to produce a decisive success overnight. It would be, as it was during the Cold War, a strategy that we would have to sustain over the long haul. But even over the long haul, I think that strategy would be more affordable and more likely to yield success than the global war on terror as conceived by the Bush administration.
When you served in the military, it was during the Cold War, and you described yourself as a Cold Warrior then. When you watched from afar Russia invade Georgia, did you think, here we go again, this is Cold War too?
No. No. I mean, I think it's important for, you know, let's do a quick comparison. Soviet Union, motivated by, at least to a degree or at some point, a universalist ideology. Today's Russia, motivated by nationalism. Soviet Union, totalitarian state. Today's Russia, authoritarian. Soviet Union had a Red Army that was massive, was very well equipped, was positioned in Eastern Europe for offensive operations. The Russian army today is not insignificant, but nothing like the old Soviet army. So this is not going to produce, unless we insist on it, is not going to produce a revival of the Cold War. My assessment would be this, that when the Cold War ended and the West was strong and the Russians were weak, the West exploited Russian weakness. And we embarked upon a series of policies, some of them wise. I think the incorporation of Eastern Europe into the EU was a good thing to do. Some of them wise, some of them perhaps not so wise. And the Russians continuously objected, and we continuously said, we're not interested in what you think. Well, we've now gone up to and into the traditional sphere of influence of Russia. We are now in a position where they are no longer as weak as they were 15 years ago, and they poked us back. And they've indicated clearly that they will not permit Western intrusion into, further into, that sphere of influence. I mean, from the Russian point of view, we have been pushing them around for the last 20 years, and to tell you the truth, we got away with it. We got away with it in Eastern Europe. We got away with it in the Balkans. And now, finally, 20 years later, they're beginning to push back a little bit. Well, I would say we should be happy that we took about 15 tricks in a row before the Russians were able to take one trick.
One of the themes of your book is that if we're going to fight expensive wars, we need to make certain sacrifices in order to be able to pay for those things. And if we think our freedom is dependent on those wars, there's certain adjustments we have to make at home for those freedoms. And you contrast two presidents, Reagan and Carter, and how they dealt with things like making sacrifices at home and spending. Would you make that comparison for us?
I understand the sort of the popular verdict on Jimmy Carter as president, that he was a failed president. In many respects, I think that the verdict is a fair one. But there's one respect in which we have failed to give President Carter the credit he deserves. And that is that he is the one president of our time who, I think, understood, anticipated where our profligacy, our unwillingness to live within our means was leading. And I refer here to the famous speech he gave, well, once famous speech, in the summer of 1979, derided as the malaise speech. Didn't use the word malaise in the speech, but that's what the press dubbed it. In the midst of the second energy shock, oil shock, in which he argued that the United States, I think both culturally and economically, was headed down a path that in which we would not simply lose our way, but ultimately come to embrace a false understanding of the freedom that we all profess to cherish. And Carter said, we're becoming too materialistic, we're becoming too much about acquiring, we're becoming too self-indulgent, and we need to change. And Carter said, really, the energy crisis, this growing energy dependence, which not only poses a direct threat to us, also provides us with the opportunity to change, to learn to live within our means, to scrutinize what we mean by freedom and perhaps come to the conclusion that it's not simply consumption and acquisition. And he made that presentation to the nation, and the nation rejected it out of hand. And in many respects, I think that presentation doomed his chances for being reelected to a second term. Now, Carter's antagonist in that election ends up being Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, the great hero of the contemporary Republican Party. Ronald Reagan, the great hero of conservatives. Ronald Reagan, that people believe somehow was this champion of traditional values. But he was not a champion of traditional values. What Ronald Reagan said, and the reason Ronald Reagan got elected, is Ronald Reagan said, don't listen to this guy Carter who says you need to get by with less. We're America. We'll never have to get by with less. There's always going to be more. And that was the message we, the people, wanted to hear. And that was what brought Ronald Reagan to the presidency. And in many respects, that's the policies that Ronald Reagan ended up pursuing. So, yes, big buildup of American military power, but also enormous deficits. He didn't shrink the government. He didn't restore traditional values, however we wanted to define traditional values. He became the most successful president of the modern era, and he became the most successful president by acting on the notion that Americans should have, right now, whatever it is they say they want and they need, without worrying about tomorrow or the next generation or who's going to pay the bills.
Let me just ask you a little bit about another turning point in your own life. You write that when, you know, after you left the military, when you started thinking about foreign policy, you were a conservative, and a Catholic conservative.
I am a Catholic conservative.
Do you still think of yourself as conservative?
I do. I think I am conservative because I am absolutely persuaded that the Bush administration is not conservative, and indeed the Republican Party is not conservative. Now, I think the term conservative, not unlike the term liberal or progressive in contemporary usage, can be defined in a variety of ways. I think relevant to this conversation, which is mostly about foreign policy, my own definition of conservative would include the following. First of all, we need to see the world as it actually is. We need to recognize that the world or history is it's not a morality play. It's not a contest between good and evil. History does not have some predetermined direction toward the triumph of freedom. I think that's a conservative view of the world. And I think along with that, we need to have a conservative view of ourselves, which means seeing ourselves as we really are and seeing American history as it really is. You know, don't indulge in the mythic narrative of the United States as liberator. The true narrative of American history is a narrative of expansion, in which beginning shortly after 1776, a series of, for the most part, very shrewd and frequently ruthless statesmen set out to enhance the power of the United States of America step by step, enhance the wealth and prosperity of the American people step by step, and to make possible thereby the access to ever greater freedom for the American people. And that narrative, roughly from the time of end of the Revolutionary War up through the 1960s, albeit with missteps along the way, was a monumentally successful project. As the United States goes from being this very small, inconsequential, insignificant country on the eastern seaboard of North America to becoming the greatest power in all the world. Now, my argument also goes on, and I think this is where a conservative realism is absolutely imperative today. My argument is that since the 1960s, roughly, more or less, this notion of expansionism fostering greater power and abundance and facilitating the pursuit of freedom, that's become undone. That efforts to expand since the 1960s, and here above all, I would point to the global war on terror as an example, efforts to expand since the 1960s are having the effect of squandering American power, wasting our wealth, and compromising our freedom. So I think I'm a conservative, acknowledging that my conservatism doesn't look like George W. Bush's conservatism.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on the program.
Andrew Bacevich is the author of The Limits of Power. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. It's easy for those outside the African-American Christian tradition to overlook how much power and history both the churches and their music carry. And even gospel fans might not realize how many non-famous performers have done stirring work decade after decade. A new anthology called Classic African-American Gospel displays the range and persistence of sacred music. Critic Milo Miles has a review.
If Mo Ash had a guiding philosophy when he ran Folkways Records from the 1940s into the 1980s, it was go for the margins. Partly out of populism and partly out of parsimony, Folkways preferred the favorite local performers to the national star, the unadorned ensemble to the elaborate act, field recordings rather than studio sessions, even the part-timer to the solid professional. This method favors tradition-minded musicians and produces a body of work that shows how different modes of music persist through many decades and how supposedly distinct types of music intersect over time. I've never heard a finer showcase for the stark and simple folkways mode than classic African-American gospel, selected by Kip Lornell of George Washington University. Of course, the starkest and simplest recording is the solo human voice. As Lornell notes, there's something of the 19th century spiritual in Doc Reed's 1950 version of Low Down Death Right Easy.
Yes, Tipperama bed right easy, right easy, right easy. Yes, Tipperama bed right easy, bring God's sermon home. Yes, low down the chariot right easy, right easy, right easy. Yes, low down the chariot right easy, bring God's servant home. Yes.
Now, one a cappella track from Doc Reed can be thrilling, but listening to six of them could feel like a chore. This collection excels at changing the sounds but keeping the plain-spoken, down-home feel of the performances right up front. This is that rarest of anthologies, one that's diverse in style but unified in concept. Strong personalities abound, though. For example, the Missionary Quartet from the Bahamas delivers my new favorite version of Dry Bones, the old thigh bone connected to the hip bone number.
Oh, bones, dry bones are walking.
Good God Almighty, dry bones are talking.
Bones, 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 you hear me? Oh, bones, you hear the word of the Lord, and your toe and your foot bone, a joint together and your foot and your ankle bone, a joint on your ankle and your leg bone, a joint together and your leg and your knee bone, a joint on your knee and your thigh bone, a joint together and your thigh and your hip bone, a joint on Ezekiel saw, the wheels are rolling,
oh Lord, it was the turning over,
Ezekiel saw, the wheels are rolling.
Classic African-American gospel not only features blues gospel mixtures from the likes of Reverend Gary Davis, Leadbelly, and more surprising Little Brother Montgomery, but a remarkable blend by Sister Ernestine Washington and the veteran jazz trumpeter Bunk Johnson. In this rendition of the classic Where Could I Go, you really can't tell where the New Orleans swing leaves off and the gospel testifying begins. Given the mandate of historical overview, compiler Lornell is obliged to include as many gospel styles as possible. And the one time the program flies off course is with the Mississippi Mass Choir. To me, mass choirs deliver grandiose productions and supercharged lead vocals that sound more frantic than ecstatic. Put it this way, it's the only track that might make you think of Mariah Carey. The final cut in a collection by the brass band called Madison's Lively Stones was done in the mid-90s. But it sounds like they could have been captured in the years right after World War II, when folkways was just starting out. We'll be right back. The lack of polish and pretense on classic African-American gospel combines with uncommonly sharp tune selection to create an atmosphere where Lead Belly is no more famous than Horace Sprott. The Fisk Jubilee singer is no more venerable than the Thrasher Wonders. The music and the congregation of voices singing it are the stars.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed the new anthology Classic African-American Gospel on the Smithsonian Folkways label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.